It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. So we're here with Brendan O'Connor. He's written a series of articles for The Nation about a conference that we wrote about in It's Going Down, which brought together lie lords like Jack Posobiec and Mike Cernovich, kind of from the Pizzagate InfoWars universe. Also, some people notably from far-right populist or neo-fascist parties like the AfD, which, if you're paying attention to what's happening in Germany, have played a strong role in organizing far-right demonstrations, has brought lots of neo-Nazis and other people out into the streets. And Brendan was there in the mix. So can you just, let's, before we kind of get into our broader conversation, which is kind of about Trumpism and also just kind of like where a lot of this stuff is going, let's just talk a little bit about the conference itself. If you just kind of want to describe it for people.
Sure. So it was a 3-day long conference in St. Louis that was structured basically like an ideas festival. Like it was like the headline that my editor put on my first piece was Davos for Fascists. And there was somebody tweeted at me in response to that headline, like, well, then what's regular Davos? But that's maybe beside the point. But yeah,
I mean, some of these workshop titles were literally like, it was like literally every single flavor of reactionary politics, like anti-feminism, you know, what's wrong with trans people. My favorite mm-hmm. one was, like why higher CO2 levels will actually benefit humanity.
Oh yeah, no, it really kind of ran the gamut of the wider like far right project of the world that they are building and want to impose on everyone else.
Yeah, and another one of your articles, kind of a more analysis piece, you wrote about how conspiracy theories kind of like created a string which kind of unites a lot of this stuff. And I like how you brought up, you know, this continuing idea of a clash of civilizations, whether it was between like Islam or in Christianity or just, you know, Western civilization, whatever that is, and, you know, something else, but also tying this into more explicitly white nationalist groups or even things like the Proud Boys, which kind of have a more nuanced approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this was something that I was really struck by over the course of the weekend, is like how thoroughly kind of self-contained the far right worldview is, and how detached it is from the reality that most people, certainly most like poor and working people, experience. And like these narratives about like fake news and alternative facts, and it's a world of just like intense paranoia and conspiracies everywhere, which I think is kind of like I think that is kind of necessary, or has become necessary to sustain a lot of the internal contradictions of this movement and these groups, to reach out and create this narrative, or these other kinds of narratives that explain away the contradictions in a way that is completely bonkers, but is it's accepted at face value.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. You brought up that how different kind of like their overall worldview is with the realities that everyday people are facing, and I think fundamentally that's kind of at the heart of what we're going to be talking about. Like, will that inherent contradiction lead to a collapse of Trumpism, or we don't know, but we're going to get into the questions now. But Michael Moore just came out with a new documentary. There's an extended trailer, and I think the audio has been published before, but he did kind of a speech about why Trump won. But in it, he argues that Trump was swept into power by the declassed white middle class that was born out of the labor struggles and the post-World War II period. And also because Trump was seen as somebody that was hated by elites, promised jobs, and he was seen as somebody that would at least ostensibly stand up to corporate globalization. Meanwhile, others have argued that Trump kind of represents this push to reaffirm whiteness in wider American society. And this is something that people have been, academics and researchers have been debating. But I think looking back 2 years on, especially with the conference in mind, what do you make of the rise of Trumpism? Is it both of these things, or is it more one thing than the other?
I'm going to take the easy way out and say both. But I mean, it's not the easy way out. Like, I don't think that we can separate the collapse of the labor movement, of the economy, of globalization, and like the American middle class, and the downwardly mobile middle class from like the project of whiteness. I think those two things are intimately related and intertwined. And I think that these downwardly mobile middle class white people who make up a significant portion of Trump's base and like are the constituency for Trumpism, what we would describe as Trumpism, are increasingly reliant upon their whiteness as an identity, as like a source of like status and power, because they're losing. As they're losing kind of economic status and power, so I think it's both, and these things interact in really complicated ways, but I don't think that we can talk about one without talking about the other.
I mean, did you get a sense? You kind of mentioned this in one of the articles when you were kind of talking about the class background of a lot of people that are really support Trump. Yeah. And you were talking to somebody, you mentioned how a lot of the people that really are into Trump that you've met are kind of like, small business owners or, to use a Marxist phrase, petty bourgeoisie.
Mm-hmm.
And then the person you were talking to mentioned like, oh, yeah, I own a business. I'm just kind of curious, is that kind of the feeling that you got from people that were there? Not necessarily the presenters themselves or the talking heads, but just the rank and file that were there. Were they, sort of, I guess, upper middle class?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think, just like going into it, that was my expectation. I mean, you have to be able to afford a plane ticket to St. Louis and to be able to stay in a hotel for 3 days and pay a ticket to attend, which was a couple hundred dollars. So it takes a certain amount of expendable income to be able to attend this kind of thing in the first place. And yeah, this woman approached me seemingly with the intention of explaining that the people who were attending were not who I imagined them to be. I think that she imagined that I imagined that, Trump voters are you know, are poor, uneducated, you know, it's sort of like, she said something to me, like, what did she say to me? She said, the media wants to portray us as stupid, lower class people, but we're not. And I was like, oh no, I know you're not. I know.
Right.
Yeah, because I mean, every time that I, whether it's at a conference like this, or I mean, over the summer I was out in Portland for one of the Patriot Prayer mobilizations, and I was talking to their supporters, and I was asking them, like, what do you do? And almost everyone described themselves as middle class or a small business owner. And so it's not, you know, this idea that the constituency for the far right, for neo-fascism, for Trumpism is like, it's primarily working class is, you know, we know historically that's not true. And I think that's been thoroughly discredited over the last 2 years in this contemporary instance.
Yeah.
Right. You know, one of the things that I found very interesting, you know, when you're writing about the conference in St. Louis, you notice the lack of millennials or even people like, for instance, below 40.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does this mean that the alt-right itself is kind of falling away, you know, as that was largely something that was made up of millennials? Or is that groups like Turning Point USA don't exactly have as much juice as maybe they want people to think? You know, there was a conference, I think in Chicago that happened, you know, a couple months ago, and they had planned like over 1,000 people to show up, and like only a couple hundred came. Or is it just that young people don't really give a shit about Trumpism, or, you know, shit like Pizzagate, or, you know, whatever kind of white genocide stuff they're promoting? I'm just, you know, yeah. What does it mean that, you know, they have a conference and it's largely, you know, baby boomers and beyond?
Well, I wouldn't want to read too much into the absence of young people at this particular conference. Like, this was organized by Bothley Eagle Forum Education and Defense Legal Council, or whatever the legal fund, which is like a long-standing paleo-conservative institution that has a base of support, has a donor base, has you know, they've got their mailing lists of people that they turn out. I think their primary organizing issue over the past few decades has been rolling back reproductive legislation around reproductive rights. So like, they have their kind of, they have their people, and this was for them, not necessarily for the alt-right or the so-called alt-right. I mean, Charlie Kirk was there, Jack Sobiech was there, these young people that have emerged as like the millennial avatars or rather the avatars for like millennial reactionaries, were there and warmly welcomed. But I don't think that we can learn a whole lot about like the state of like the far right youth movement from this particular conference. I wouldn't really have expected them to be there in numbers.
Sure. But even looking at something like the mother of all rallies, mm-hmm, that happened in DC a couple weeks ago, I mean, if you look at the crowd, you know, for one, it was only a couple hundred again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was largely baby boomers. And I'm just curious if,
yeah,
if you're seeing like a break between kind of like the base that's basically just going to stick with Trump, and like that's where kind of like, you know, the poll is, and then the alt-right, which is kind of like drifting away maybe more from it.
Yeah, I do think that, like, something is happening. I think there is there's instability in this kind of loose coalition. I mean, with respect to the Mother of All rallies, or even like the Unite the Right, the two in DC a couple of weeks before, I think it's very clear that the street movement, at least on the East Coast, has been soundly demoralized. I wouldn't say defeated, but it is incredibly demoralized. I think it's a little bit different in the Pacific Northwest. And that being the case, I think, yeah, like there's fewer and fewer young people turning out for that kind of thing, whether that's because the social cost of doing so and being identified and being doxxed has been successfully raised. I mean, I think that's probably the case. I mean, but I also think that what might be happening is something similar to what happens with like left and progressive movements, is that it's being co-opted a little bit. Like a lot of these ideas and this rhetoric and the discourse of white nationalism is being co-opted and absorbed into the institutions that surround the Republican Party. I think that the young people are probably going with it. I mean, there was some alt-right kid who was outed as, you know, he was like an intern at the Heritage or a fellow at like the Heritage Foundation or something, just recently. I don't remember the exact details, but I'm sure that is
Troy Warden, who was the former head of the Berkeley College Republicans.
Yeah, exactly. So like, I think that, you know, these kids who are vulnerable to these ideas or are attracted to these ideas, there are paths for them to take that are less risky socially than turning out for a torchlit rally, but that are just as and possibly even more dangerous, like in the long run, because we already see that there's an existing continuum and pathway between white nationalist institutions like the Federation on American Immigration Reform and the executive branch.
Right.
So like that, those paths exist already. Like they don't need to build new ones. And so I think that is, to me, that is reason to be cautious in like diagnosing that, like, well, like young people aren't into this anymore.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but there's a lot of interesting questions within that. We don't really have all the answers because the alt-right is kind of, very different in the sense that it celebrates recuperation. Like it wants, you know, it wants Tucker Carlson to like say the things that it thinks, like it wants President Trump to like support them and like, you know, dog whistle to them. Like it wants all those things, like whether, you know, like most subcultures, you know, most music genres, most political movements, like hate the idea that the established order is going to like basically take on their own talking points and like try to recuperate off of them. I mean, but the alt-right is very different in that sense. But yeah, I mean, also, I mean, like for instance, like the reporter from Vice just did that kind of like year follow-up on the alt-right, and one of the scenes they like show that kind of like iconic kid in Identity Europa at the torchlit rally, and he's like screaming And you know, then the next scene they show him and he's at CPAC. Mm-hmm. Kind of like you were saying, like, you know, he's, it says like ex-white nationalist, but here he is at CPAC like months later. And the question is like, you know, is he going to do more damage within the machine? You know, they already want to take over the state and create, you know, a fascist one. But I mean, is he going to do more damage within the Republican Party than he is in a group of three Identity Europa, you know, cops that run around and, you know, try to drop a banner once a month, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's a big question. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I have been thinking about this a lot, and I've written about this question a little bit before, and this to me became like after the collapse of the traditionalist worker party, like this was kind of this became a very stark question to me, is like there isn't actually a from a certain angle, there isn't actually like a structural need for a far right street movement when you have a state that is fundamentally sympathetic and open to the ideas and the policies and the worldview that the street movement would want to advocate for.
Right.
Like they have state power. This is happening. So I do think that the idea that there is an institutional and kind of like official home for these people is very troubling, because as dangerous as these street organizations are, I mean, anybody who has been paying attention to obviously these street organizations are dangerous, but the level of violence that they can inflict pales in comparison to what the state can do.
Right, right. Well, this kind of brings us to our next question, but you know, a lot of people, like, you know, we saw this thing as like very scary in the sense that it was kind of bringing, you know, different elements of the far right. I mean, you had people that were associated with the, you know, far right Christian elements. You had people like Joe Arpaio, and then, you know, they're rubbing shoulders with, you know, Mike Cernovich, Turnpoint USA, and then also these MPs from, you know, in Germany, the Alternative for Germany party, and also the Polish party, which I think is like the Law and Justice party, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, both could be described as, you know, Breitbart would describe them as populist parties. You know, they'd probably better be described as, you know, far right, nationalist, populist. You know, some people would call them neo-fascist. I know the AfD in Germany, they just had their youth wing shut down in some cities because of their connection to neo-Nazi organizations within Germany. But they have played a huge role in organizing a lot of the demonstrations that have been happening in the past month in relation to a young man supposedly being murdered by an Iraqi and Syrian immigrant. And, you know, the far right has... after that killing, you know, took the streets and, you know, have been attacking people, leftists, refugees, people of color, on the streets. And, you know, in some instances, you know, in the thousands, and this continues today. There's still, massive demonstrations that are taking place across Germany in regards to this. But, I'm just curious if you could, comment on that. And was that like a very, was that a point that they really made, that they were trying to kind of bridge, you know, far right parties in Europe with, you know, far right populism here in the U.S.?
Yes, that was very explicit. Peter Bystrin from AfD and Dominik Tarzynski from the Polish Law and Justice Party were very clear that they are seeking, especially in the European Parliament, to build a block of far-right reactionary populist parties to do something, presumably to dismantle the EU project. I'm not sure exactly. That's kind of beyond my purview. But there, like, this was clearly an opportunity for the two of them, not only to connect to like American allies, but to connect with each other and to strengthen their relationship. And so that was pretty unsettling to watch happen. And also because the two of them are, it was surreal to see them in the same room as somebody like Mike Cernovich or Charlie Kirk or whomever, because Cernovich and Kirk are sort of like buffoons. They're dangerous, but they're clowns. And Bistrin and Terzinski are scary. Like, they are scary dudes. Not just for what they were saying, but just kind of their, I don't know. This is not very, like, this is not a very materialist analysis, but just kind of the way that they carried themselves. Like, these are guys that know that they are building towards power. I mean, the Law and Justice Party is the ruling party in Poland. Like, right. Terzinski is a powerful person, and he holds some very scary ideas.
Well, I think that's the thing. It's like, and we're going to talk about this later, but like this kind of coming together of, I mean, like, for instance, in Germany, the AfD has benefited from the fact that there are like underground, neo-Nazi assassination squads, and there's, groups of neo-Nazi skinheads that go out and burn down refugee centers and stuff, and like have pushed things so far to the right that they can almost appear as like a centrist force to like kind of like bring order. But I mean, they also have power out in the streets. I mean, they can turn out people to demonstrations. Whereas like somebody like Cernovich, he might have, a couple hundred thousand followers on Twitter, but I mean, if he were going to give a speech tomorrow, his hometown, like, five people would come out and see him. There's not that, like they might be able to like cause like some sort of like social media virality online, but I mean, it doesn't necessarily translate to like a material force in the streets, whereas these people have that. Mm-hmm. And, like you're saying, it's very frightening. I think that's kind of an interesting difference between the U.S. and Europe, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But, I mean, also in the fact, like, if you look at Trump, I mean, Trump is widely unpopular. Most of his policies are very unpopular. And I'm kind of curious, your thoughts on that as well. Just, I mean, that kind of difference, like you were saying, like, you've got, like, these buffoons up here that, like, believe in, alien pedophile rings and, literally are, like, on stuff like InfoWars where they're talking about, like, multidimensional, literal goblin shapeshifters, and then you've got people that are, like, running countries.
Mm-hmm.
And they, like, look at each other as, like, allies. I mean, it's, in some ways, it's kind of, like, strange.
Yeah, well, it is weird. I think the other, another thing that we need to think about is, like, I mean, it highlighted the difference between how good the far right in Europe is at street politics and street organizing, and how terrible the far right is here at that. And I think that is part of what, people like Joey Gibson and Peter Prayer and the Proud Boys in the Pacific Northwest are either consciously or unconsciously trying to I think that's part of their project, is to like show how the American far right can do street politics. What we have here in the United States is a very powerful and wealthy political class, like elite political class, that knows how to spend their money and knows how to take over and disrupt and exploit like legalistic power and institutional power, and is very good at doing that, and because they're good at doing that, they can force through, like they can, you know, force through policies that are not actually popular, but they have the kind of formal means to do it anyway, and you know, this is all part of like the GOP laying the groundwork for like minoritarian rule, where you know you have a ruling class that is able to maintain the appearance of democracy while doing things that are like by any measure wildly unpopular.
I wanted to turn now to talk about Tucker Carlson. We mentioned him a little earlier, but I mean, you know, something that's clearly promoting, you know, white nationalist talking points. I mean, you know, we don't have to go through it all, but the one thing that's interesting about him, and people brought this up a couple weeks ago when he mentioned Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon. But I mean, he continually, you know, talks about elites, you know, the ruling class. This is something that like Trump has done a little bit of himself. But I mean, it's interesting because a lot of people, I think, on the left kind of like got freaked out, like they were going to like take these words from us or something like that, which is, you know, traditionally what fascists have always done is they've basically taken a lot of leftist talking points or, you know, turned like talk of a ruling class around to really mean like a cabal of like wealthy liberals or Jews or, you know, but also like, you know, the conspiracy that those in power have is they really want to get rid of all the white people or, you know, destroy Western civilization or Christianity or, you know, like stuff like, you know, Alex Jones is always going back to like, you know, every conspiracy, every threat of civil war is really just an excuse for the left to like kill all the white people or kill all the Trump supporters. And I'm just curious your thoughts when you see somebody like Tucker Carlson not only promoting white nationalist talking points, but also starting to inject discussion of things like, you know, a ruling class or an idea of like the elites or even like a, you know, a pseudo anti-capitalist stance, which is ironic because, I mean, if you don't know Tucker Carlson, he's the heir to the Swanson frozen food fortune. Oh. So, I mean, he himself is, you know, he's not some like, you know, out of luck working man that just one day decided to put on a bow tie. I mean, he comes very much from money.
Yeah, I mean, I was a little bit disappointed in my timeline, in my Twitter timeline, that like so many people were surprised or were shocked or baffled that
or
Tucker,
supportive.
Yeah, we're supportive.
Tucker's so woke.
that he would go down this rhetorical path. I mean, there's deep historical precedent for at least superficial anti-capitalist critique from fascist and pre-fascist movements. But also, like, you know, I mean, it's as if everybody just forgot, like, Trump's whole campaign. Which absolutely, like, over and over again deployed this rhetoric of, like, speaking for / to, like, the working class. And you know, talking about, talking about in a kind of roundabout way, capitalism and the effects of capitalism. I mean, what do I think when I hear Tucker doing that? I mean, I think I don't think that it is something. Okay, so just because I was unsurprised doesn't mean that I think it's something to be dismissed. I think that like people on the left, like or like organizers in all different parts of the struggle need to be prepared to talk about capitalism, and so and I think that this is, you know, this is kind of a problem, is that like a lot of the different struggles that people are engaged in are still a little bit atomized, and like whether we are talking about the struggle for reproductive justice or immigration justice, or labor rights or whatever, like we always need to be able to relate it back to capitalism, because if we don't, people like Tucker Carlson are going to, and I mean, it's obviously a lie. Like it's completely disingenuous. Like, and again, we know, we can see from the historical record how this rhetoric is violently jettisoned as soon as they consolidate power. But it is important for us to take it seriously that like this is something that they're talking about.
Right. And I mean, obviously there are factions within the elites. I mean, I'm sure the fact that Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post is a reason that a lot of people on the right would want to go after him. Mm-hmm. And you know, the day and age we live in is very much so of like, you know, these kind of like pseudo fascist, you know, populist like Bannon on one side, and then you have, you know, tech capital on the other, which, you know, you know, which is kind of like the twin pillars of where a lot of power lies in today. But I mean, it's just interesting, like the other day there was somebody from Chapo Trap House was on the Young Turks, and the guy from the Young Turks kind of like had the Chapo, it was Virgil on to kind of like discuss, you know, where they were coming from. It was kind of like this, oh, this up and coming, you know, leftist, you know, like on the Young Turks, which is seen as, you know, kind of like the InfoWars of, you know, the progressive, you know, liberalism. And it was funny because they basically got into, you know, the topic of capitalism, and Virgil was explaining why they were anti-capitalist, and that's where the Young Turks kind of draw the line. And I think that kind of like goes back to what you were speaking about, where it's like, well, all of a sudden then you've just allowed Tucker Carlson to be kind of more radical than you, because all of a sudden Tucker seems to have kind of like, you know, a critique of the elites and, you know, capitalism itself and corporations, whereas, you know, you just kind of seem as like this kind of classical liberal that just wants everything to be fair. And
but yeah, I mean like you used the example of Jeff Bezos, and like if we are not able to talk about why, like, we have a different explanation for why the power that Jeff Bezos wields, the capital that he owns, the fact that he owns, Amazon, Whole Foods, and the Washington Post. Like, this is a problem. And if we are not able to offer our explanation of why this is a problem, it's just, yeah, it, like, people like Tucker Carlson are going to, and it's going to be instrumentalized towards, reactionary ends. And
right,
yeah,
and there's also been numerous times where you know, people on the left have like looked over at people on the far right and been like, oh, okay, well, they're, you know, they're okay on some of this stuff. Like, I remember that was, you know, something, a lot of the stuff that David Duke was talking about resonated with some people, and there was like some like weird crossover. I remember listening to some weird interview where Pat Buchanan was sitting with Ralph Nader, and they were talking about how, you know, there was a lot of like similarities between a lot of the stuff that they wanted in terms of, you know, against globalization and trade, and just like, it's kind of terrifying that there would be, you know, again, this kind of crossover, between, you know, essentially white nationalists and, you know, milquetoast progressive, you know, liberals. But, just kind of moving on in terms of, you know, again, talking about kind of like class issues and money, you know, we've seen the first year of the Trump tax cuts, you know, working people are paying more into the system while corporations are getting massive tax breaks. You know, meanwhile, you know, all the stuff that everybody that listens to this should know already, but wages are stagnant. You know, there's a rise in the gig economy, service sector jobs. But yet, you know, everything that we hear about from Trump or even from, you know, the CNN or MSNBC camp is just, you know, how great the economy is doing, and, you know, which is supposed to resonate with us, like how great that we're doing. You know, meanwhile, like, you know, there, it looks like there might be a huge strike in steel and other industries that are facing different tariffs and stuff like that. A lot of people are pointing to a coming of another financial collapse. Also, the Republicans are talking about how they want even more tax cuts. There was somebody from the Trump administration came out and said that, you know, because of the deficit going up, which it has under the Republican administration, that they're going to need to push for drastic cuts in Medicare and Medicaid. So the question is, will these contradictions at some point become so glaring to a segment of Trump's base? And I think this kind of speaks to, you know, the steel strike. There's actually an interesting Vice short on this about the strike, and about they were interviewing some of the workers that voted for Trump and just kind of how pissed off they are. But is this going to create such a glaring contradiction in Trump base, especially those that voted for him on supposedly class issues? that it's going to, you know, cause problems for Trumpism, or has that process already begun?
I mean, I think where we have to start with that is that, like, the conditions that produced Trumpism have not receded and have in fact accelerated, and that is happening in conjunction with an acceleration of, like, the climate crisis, which in turn, you know, which in turn increases, like, displacement and increases migration. So, like, all of these things are continuing to come to a head. Do I think that the contradictions within Trumpism are going to lead to people turning away from it? I'm not confident that it will, because I think that the stranglehold that the right-wing media has on these people, with the flagship being Fox News, but there being a whole constellation of smaller, more extreme versions of Fox News.
Right.
The stranglehold that universe has on Trump's base is probably unbreakable. And that being the case, I think that it then becomes really hard. It's hard for me to imagine that people who are already committed to this political project are suddenly going to realize, like, wait, this is all actually bullshit. Because I think that what's being offered as, like, an explanation for the contradictions is really powerful and compelling. I don't know.
So for instance, in the Vice documentary I brought up, they had somebody, they basically interviewed two people, and they were both steel workers, and they were both union people, and they had both voted to go out on strike, and they were kind of waiting to see what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of them was like a Bernie person, lefty, senior, so we already know where he stands. Mm-hmm. The other person was like a ex-vet guy, mid-40s, you know, and he called himself, you know, far right or right wing or something like that. But I mean, he was, you know, very pissed. And it was funny because his whole thing, he's like, you know, Trump campaigned on, you know, on talking to the working man. And I can't understand why Trump would do this, why Trump would sell us out. Like, you know, he basically made the argument that the right wing position would be to help the little guy as opposed to, you know, the corporations, which, you know, when you say it, it's just, you know, so bizarre. But I think that's what Trumpism has done, is kind of like warped this, like, pseudo class position. Mm-hmm. I think, like, you know, when people are confronted with it, I mean, personally, I think that, like, some of his base will fall away. I think a lot of what you're saying is completely right, that, like, the hardcore, like, ideological people that are, like, you know, that's where they lie. Like, they like, mm-hmm. you know, the stance that Trump has, like, and moreover, like, you know, they hate who he hates. I think that's the big part. Mm-hmm. But I think the people that opportunistically, you know, would have gone for Bernie, you know, but went for Trump or whatever, or, you know, really wanted their job back, or they thought that Trump would do X, Y, Z. I think those people will hopefully fall away, or at least see that, like, you know, they got, you know, swindled.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, that's totally possible. And I don't think that, like, I don't think that it's you know, the situation is like hopeless or anything. And like, you know, we were talking about the prospect of a steelworker strike. There's the prospect of a huge UPS workers, Teamster strike at UPS. There were, you know, teachers strikes in red states all across the country last year, and it looks likely that there will be more in this coming school year. And those will include people who voted for Trump. But like, that's also, you know, but then we're talking about like, then we're talking about the power of the labor movement and unions. And like, as we well know, that movement is much diminished, and so like the number of workers who may have voted for Trump, who may have gotten taken in by some of that worker rhetoric, who are organized and in a position to be like brought into struggle that will show them that they were. That they were wrong, and that like that they're organized and like an alternative is being offered to them, like that's not a huge number of people. I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it's bigger than I imagine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that kind of like begs the question of like, so what is the future of Trumpism now in a country where, you know, the largest political position is that I hate the president, and that, you know, that the Trump's base is somewhat getting smaller, but at the same time, I mean, you know, if polls are to believe, you know, 1 in 4, 1 in 5 people like just, you know, really love this guy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, they're not going to go away anytime soon. So I think, it begs the question of just, you know, in the United States, what will be the future of Trumpism, but also just like, you know, will Trumpism be, you know, the continued vehicle of the Republican Party? Even if it's just kind of like this right-wing populism is kind of a veneer for, you know, an accelerated version of neoliberalism or whatever it is.
Well, I mean, I think a couple of things. I think that Trumpism is here to stay, whether it has Trump as its figurehead or someone else takes his place. I don't think that this, I don't think that this is gonna, we're gonna like shift back. I think that this is a permanent part of our politics now. I think that a lot of it, I think a lot of it depends on, like you described, like the, you know, you described this part of this, alliance is like a kind of extreme version of neoliberalism, and the ostensible opposite Democrats is just a less extreme version of neoliberalism. And so I think that a lot of like the next 5, 10, 20, 50 years is going to be contingent upon the left outside of the Democratic left. Contingent upon the ability of left anti-capitalist movements and organizations to build power in their own right, because like this crisis in the parties, this crisis of elites that has like opened up space for Trumpism, and the crisis outside of the elites in like material conditions is not going anywhere. So I think the situation is critical.
Right. Do you see, I mean, you know, you were out in Michigan earlier this year. I mean, and we were talking before about, you were saying like, at least on the East Coast, it seems like the far right street movements are kind of waning. Even people like Joey Gibson. I mean, Joey Gibson just went out to this Free Alex Jones thing in Austin. It seemed pretty lackluster. you know, in the town where Alex Jones has built a brand and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, do you see the far right street movement continuing to kind of wane, or is it just because, you know, they're placated right now with Trump in power? Because I think in many ways, like if, like for instance, let's say there is a blue wave, and even a lot of like DSA backed people or enough, you know, get into office where somebody can actually point and be like, they're everywhere. You know, mm-hmm. they might even have more, they might have like a Syriza moment where they're like, you know, they could make up some conspiracy about how the communists have taken over. And, you know, that's what really fucks things up is when, you know, then the Democrats, you know, got a bunch of people elected. Like, this could even, what I'm saying is, you know, this could just be the start of something larger.
Yeah, I think that that's likely. Like, I think that left anti-capitalist movements and organizations will breed and provoke, like, extreme reaction and repression, both from the state and like para-state organizations. I mean, and like a good example of that recently is like Project Veritas, which is basically just working on behalf of the Trump administration to like root out leftist civil servants.
Right. Their last thing was just people that were DSA members that had government jobs or.
Yeah. And I mean, and this was framed as like the deep state, like these people are the deep state. These are just like, you know, administrative people who just like have normal jobs. Like they're just normal jobs. Like these are not political appointees. These are not, people who are running things. Like they're, you know, 20 and 30 something. So like, but I think that is like paradigmatic. Like I think that that kind of thing is going to increase if the left increases in strength. And I mean, obviously that's very much an open question.
One of the last MAGA rallies was basically saying that, like, you know, Antifa is the deep state or trying to tie, which is just, you know, such a ridiculous statement. It doesn't even make any sense. But I mean, it again speaks to these conspiracy theories. But just kind of like following that thread, I mean, do you feel like we're reached a point where like the camps have been so established that there's really nothing we can do about these conspiracy theories? Like the people that are going to believe that are going to believe it, and that, you know, okay, we shouldn't waste our time trying to like constantly like, you know, unpack all these things. Cause I feel like over the course of the last 2 years, like people have done a lot of solid media work about like, you know, no, there will not be an Antifa civil war in which white people will be decapitated or something, you know, like that. Or no, you know, the Parkland shooter was not a socialist activist or whatever, you know. Like, do you just feel like the world we live in now is just so already divided that the people that believe that are going to just run with that, or there's still work to be done to try to like point at these things and just say like, this is so ridiculous?
No, I absolutely believe that's necessary work. I think it's necessary work, not, I think the audience for that work is the people that we would be trying to reach are not necessarily those who like if you already believe one conspiracy theory, like if you are already a Pizzagater, the QAnon, you're gonna be into QAnon. I kind of think that once you're in, you're in, and there's kind of not a whole lot that like can be done about that. I mean, setting aside like, you know, if you have like Like, if there's somebody in your life, or there's somebody that you work with, or somebody in your union or something that, like, is, like, has these mixed up ideas, like, as individuals, like, yes, I think it's incumbent upon us to the extent that we can, like, help people see the error of their ways.
Mm. Right.
Kind of broadly and categorically, I do think it's necessary to, like, to correct those narratives in media, because it's the people, like, there are still tons of people that are, like, basically, like, up for grabs. Like we need to be more concerned with, not necessarily someone who already believes in Pizzagate, but somebody who feels, you know, who feels the contradictions of capitalism, okay, who feels like the economic stresses of life in the 21st century in the United States, and who is looking for an explanation, and who is looking for, like, a narrative and an ideas that help them understand, like, why, like, why, like, why is, like, why is my life so hard? That's the person that needs to be reached. And obviously people have agency and autonomy, and, like, are, you know, people can, like, make their own determinations about the world. But if somebody is, like, looking for an explanation, and they are, you know, yeah, I do think it's necessary
Well, that's a really good point, you know, try to reach the people that may be susceptible to the next conspiracy theory, not necessarily the people that already believed the last one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one last question. I mean, this is something I think that both organizers and also people that are doing investigative journalism or looking at the world, writing about it. But I mean, I think one big question a lot of people have been asking themselves, like, and we kind of alluded to this, but, you know, in the last month we've had somebody from the Daily Caller that's been fired due to their writing for Radix Journal, which is run by Richard Spencer, speechwriter for Trump that was fired for attending a white nationalist conference along with Richard Spencer and a lot of other people, something from the DHS that was fired for trading emails with white nationalists and so on and so forth. I'm just curious, like, as there is more of a turn into the state from a lot of these people, and I mean, like, as we've argued, like, the importance of looking at groups like something that you brought up, FAIR or Federation mm-hmm. for American Immigration Reform, which is, you know, essentially like a white nationalist think tank, which is directing a lot of the policy around immigration that we're seeing. You know, what's a good strategy for kind of going after a lot of these people? Because, I mean, there's certainly a lot of people that probably still need to be exposed that are, I'm sure, working within Fox. You know, if you look at something like the Daily Caller is just swimming with alt-right people or people that are, you know, on the alt-right. You know, I'm sure that there's some people that are involved in producing Tucker Carlson's show that are, like, feeding a lot of white nationalist talking points into that have connections. So I'm just kind of, and also just everybody with, you know, things like FAIR, what would be a way of not only exposing these people, but going about educating people as to why, you know, white nationalists entering these mainstream institutions is fairly dangerous. Or to reframe it, like, if, you know, if fascism is taking this, you know, inward stateward turn, you know, trying to gain entrance into legitimate institutions, like, how then, you know, should organizers and journalists respond, you know, when, you know, these very heinous ideas are suddenly, like, within, you know, so-called democratic institutions and businesses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think the work of exposing and identifying the individuals is really important and necessary, and is kind of like the first step. But there was a writer for Vox, Jane Costin, I believe is her last name. She was talking about, she did a Twitter thread after the guy got fired from the Daily Caller, and she kind of made the comparison that, like, if you run a kitchen and you keep catching rats in your kitchen, and every day you catch another rat in your kitchen, you wouldn't really brag about, hey, we keep catching all the rats in the kitchen, because the rats are still, like, they keep going back. Like, they're still there. Your kitchen is full of rats. And there's something kind of similar happening with, you know, with all these institutions that, you know, are firing these individuals as a result of them having been identified as having these connections. But, like, the next step is to show how it's structural, and how that these incidents don't happen in isolation, and that, like, something like FAIR or DHS, like, that the reason that these people are drawn into, like, the reason that these people are there in the first place, is not because they, like, snuck in. It's because that there is something endemic to those institutions that makes them a natural home for people with these ideas. And that's a more difficult thing to educate people on, because a lot of people are not accustomed to thinking structurally, or, like, looking at things systemically. But that's where we need to go, because otherwise you're just, you know, you're just catching individual rats.
Right, yeah, that's a very good point to make. Well, on that note, is there anything else that you want to add on either the topic of Trumpism or the conference that you covered, or anything else that we've talked about?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground. Okay. And I appreciate the opportunity to think about some of these things out loud.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, we're going to be talking about this for a long time, and
mm-hmm.
You know, like I said, I mean, this could only be, you know, the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see, like, you know, I don't know what your predictions are, if Trump will get reelected or not. I mean, at this point, I would say that it seems no, that there's quite a few people that don't like him.
I would say if I've learned anything from the past 3 years, it's to just all of the, like, worst and most implausible outcomes are almost always what happens.
that's very true. But, you know, if he doesn't win, I think it could be very possible that we could see, you know, a reacceleration of the far right again. You know,
mm-hmm.
I remember Matt Parrott, from from what was the TWP, right after Trump won, he wrote, you know, this is actually not what we wanted to happen. We wanted Hillary to win because we wanted an enemy that everybody could rally around. And now we're actually going to be forced to, you know, figure our shit out and see how it all fits together. And it ended up not really working for them, especially for Parrott. But now Matthew Einbach has a new job as community outreach director for the NSM. And what a better face of community outreach than something that beats their wife and children. But
I mean, if that's the kind of community you want, then I guess he's a good guy for it.
Exactly. Right. All right. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.